All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. You can email us, as always, at radio@thefederalist.com. I'm happy to be joined today by Jason Riley, who is at the Wall Street Journal as a columnist. He is also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and you know him from his work on Fox News, especially Special Report, where I am occasionally on with him as well. You can follow him on Twitter at Jason Riley, WSJ. Jason, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Good to be here, Ben.
So we were on the other day together, and it's always a pleasure to be on with you, even though it's it was a little bit different because I'm just hearing you as opposed to even being able to see you. And the conversation turned to the cultural side of the moment that we're currently experiencing. And it seems to me that there was this brief moment where the country was basically united, where their reactions and outrage to what they saw happen in Minneapolis was unified, that they viewed it as an act of police brutality, but that then things really went sideways into a conversation about racism that has led to a pretty extreme positioning on the part of Democrats and the left. This morning, there was an ABC News poll, an Ipsos poll out, that found something that I thought to be pretty disturbing. One, the headline that they used was 64% of Americans polled oppose defunding the police. But when you looked at the breakdown, that was basically about 90% of Republicans. It was about 70-ish percent, high 60s for independents. But 55% of Democrats were in favor of defund the police, which, however you define it, is on its face a pretty extreme term. Do you think that those numbers are generally accurate? And what do they tell you about the thought process of the country at the moment?
I guess time will tell whether they're accurate, whether that's an outlier, that result, or whether other polls back it up. We'll find out soon enough. My first takeaway from that is it's yet another example of the sort of hyper-partisan times that we live in. Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans can't agree that the sky is blue and that water is wet. And when you filter anything through a political lens these days, you seem to get those numbers. So that's not surprising. The other problem, I think, is the media coverage of these incidents. And here I see a pattern. I think we've had a lot of irresponsible media coverage of these interactions between blacks and police, and it goes back years. We saw it with Ferguson, Missouri, and Michael Brown. We saw it in Baltimore with Freddie Gray. We saw it in Chicago with Laquan McDonald. So there's a pattern here, and the media has presented these events as regular, everyday occurrences, typical experiences of Black Americans. And I think it is that narrative that has gotten people so riled up to the point where we have these protests. And I wish that the media would put things in perspective, offer some context, offer some data. They can do that when they want to, but in this case, they don't seem much interested in that. And I think the result is we have a bunch of people out there angry over a lot of the misinformation they've been fed.
One of the elements of this that was brought up the other day by one of our guests was that the Obama administration never really got to the point where we have federal data from all of these different departments. I don't know, how much you've paid attention to this, but what is the reason for that? I saw Matt Iglesias tweeting the other day, and I know normally don't cite him this much, but he's been interesting lately in a surprising way. He was making the point that we have better data about how many eggs were laid in the past month than we do about police shootings. And we have to rely on these media sources as opposed to reporting. What's the main barrier to reporting something along the lines of that kind of evidence on a national scale? Is it that we fear a federal takeover in some way of what has traditionally been state and local level responsibilities?
Well, I think it does result from our federalist system. That's certainly the case. And so you have different police departments, counting things differently, reporting things differently, and it varies from state to state, from city to city. There is no uniform national database on police shootings. I'm not opposed to putting one in place. I think it would take some effort, but I think it's just a consequence of different police departments doing things different ways. But that all presupposes that the data would calm everyone down.
I think we have
plenty of data now, quite reliable data that we've had and for some time, and the media doesn't seem interested in reporting it. The politicians, progressives in particular, and Democrats as well, don't seem particularly interested in the data. And in fact, when they are presented with data, Ben, they dismiss it, they play it down, they say it's been made up. Mm-hmm. So, we could always have better data, more data, but we can't assume that that would necessarily change the prevailing narrative. Some of the data we have is quite striking. I can give you one quick example. The New York City Police Department is the largest in the country in terms of size for the largest city in the country. And it's a department that has been keeping detailed data of police use of force going all the way back to 1971. And that year, a cop shot 314 people in New York City. By 2017, 2018, that was down to around 30.
Wow.
But you're talking about a 85, 90% reduction in police shootings and police shooting fatalities over a 4.5-decade period in the nation's largest city with the nation's largest police department. So there's some data for you. Have you heard those numbers reported? And New York is not an outlier. You can look at other large cities with large minority populations, and you will see dramatic reductions in police use of force over the past half century. Mm-hmm. Police use their weapons less often. They use lethal force less often. And we have data showing that. But it doesn't seem to... It interferes with the narrative the other side wants to push.
Well, and this narrative frustrates me the most when it comes to situations like what you see in Chicago. I mean, the most violent weekend in 60 years, during these protests and people dying. I mean, there was a piece that ran that detailed each of the shootings, and it was basically 10 minutes later, another person getting shot in a car, six blocks away. And it just jumps around these different neighborhoods and these different very similar stories. And I would think that would be huge national front page news. Everybody saying, look, this is a great American city that's been racked with violence in that ranks higher than anything they've seen in half a century in terms of a confined space of time. And yet that wasn't getting any kind of attention whatsoever. And there weren't calls for impeaching the people in charge and making big changes or increasing police presence in these areas in any significant way. Is this just a situation where the traditional media, the corporate media is just so focused on their larger ideological priorities, their narrative of what's going on, that they ignore what the big stories really are?
Well, I guess there are a couple ways to look at it, which is that police incidents involving black suspects that end the way it did with George Floyd or some of these other cases that I mentioned earlier are rare. Mm-hmm. To put it crudely, the Chicago day in and day out gunfire are the planes that land safely and don't get covered by the media. The police encounters are the plane crashes that get all the attention. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to look at it. Just as an aside, what the double whammy in the Chicago case is that Chicago, like a lot of these large urban police departments, has what's called a very low clearance rate for many of these murders, meaning many of them don't get solved then. These black people die and their killer is never caught, never brought to justice. And it's interesting that that is happening at a time when there are these calls to defund police and provide them with fewer resources. Mm-hmm. I mean, if anything, if you care about Black lives, wouldn't we want to get to the bottom of who's responsible for killing so many of these young Black men? Yet, again, that is something that just goes by the wayside.
I have been keeping track. I have this one thread on Twitter of people who are legitimately making the argument that podcasters could replace the police. And it's the whole thing started because I thought somebody was making a funny joke and I retweeted it. And then I went to her Twitter thread and I realized she was actually making the argument that no, podcasters would be better at solving crimes, at solving murders than the police would. She would have like a long argument for it. And so I've been just noting these different ones where they say podcasters. But when you say that thing about that clearance rate, can we just send all the podcasters to Chicago to take care of this?
No, like, it is. Way? It's very telling. You know, you have 7,400 Black homicides in this country every year. We know that police are responsible for maybe 2-3% of them. So even if the protesters are 100% successful in ending police violence against Blacks,
it's a drop in the bucket.
What I'm talking about here is the priorities and what is to be emphasized if your goal, in fact, is to reduce that Black body count. I mean, that's not to say you ignore police abuse. It's not to say we can't talk about police reforms or making it easier to prosecute bad police officers and so forth, or improving police tactics. Let's have all of that conversation. But we really need to put it into context and to make policing the center of this discussion about the Black homicide rate in this country is so far off base as to be ridiculous.
I think that one of the problems here too has to be that the politicians who would traditionally engage on these subjects feel very uncomfortable when dealing with issues of race. They fear being depicted as racists, and so they don't say the kind of things, they don't outline the kind of points that you're making here. Is this an issue where they can seriously overcome that, you think, in a moment when that's demanded of them? Or is it going to be like we're seeing, frankly, in my opinion, from this White House, where they feel paralyzed in talking about the issue and it's the worst of both worlds because, you know, the president kind of veers in the direction of law and order because that's his instinct. But he cannot speak to this in any way that doesn't come across as if he's just demagoguing as opposed to, you know, putting forward something that can help address the very legitimate concerns people have about the system as it goes to, you know, cops getting away with things and that type of thing, but also recognizes the truth of the situation, that the crime problem here is so big and the homicide problem is so big that it far vastly outweighs what bad things cops may be doing within these communities.
Well, someone once said, when you want to help someone else, you tell that person what they need to hear. When you want to help yourself, you tell that person what they want to hear. Politicians are largely about helping themselves. Their inability to think past the next election is famous. They're not known for having particularly stiff spines. There are exceptions, of course, but they remain exceptions. I don't look to our politicians to step up to the plate here. They could, and they could start by going around these activists who I don't think are speaking for the people they claim to be speaking for. You know, Black people call the police more than anyone else in the country, which is an odd way of showing you don't trust them. Yeah. these police officers are responding to where the 9/11 calls originate. And this idea that these neighborhoods are being over-policed is not borne out by the facts. Partly we know this because of the amount of phone calls that come from the Black community, but we also know this from data we have on crime victims. And it turns out that Blacks are arrested at right about the same rate that victims of crimes identify Blacks as their assailant. People who have no idea, no reason to lie about who came after them. Mm-hmm. If these neighborhoods were being over-policed, those two numbers wouldn't be the same. You'd have a lot more arrests of Blacks than you had Blacks being identified as the assailant by victims. So this notion, again, that these communities are being over-policed, I think, does not hold water. These communities want more policing. They want better policing. And the activists, however, have convinced the media to report just the opposite. But when you go and talk to rank and file Blacks, particularly Blacks with school-age children that have to run this obstacle course to school every day or to work every day, past all the drug dealers, past all the crime, people who sit cowered in their homes, people who during the summertime in Chicago sleep on the floor at night because a bullet might be coming through the wall. You know, this isn't the Klan driving through the south side of Chicago shooting up the place. Mm-hmm. These are other young Black men spraying these playgrounds. You know, birthday parties get destroyed over this. This is just an unbelievable carnage. And to act, to pretend that the police are the source of this, or that policing is the main factor here, is so at odds with reality. But again, the activists are allowed to get away with, obviously pushing a political agenda, and the media accepts that largely uncritically. And I think that's part of the problem.
The power of the media in this moment is pretty amazing to me. Replaying the video of Floyd over and over again obviously ginned up significant response across the country. The combination of being locked down for so many months, of feeling confused and frustrated about people to blame and which play to turn. I think John Podoritz has said this, a couple of other people have said this, that there's kind of a flight to safety going on here of, oh, at least this is something where we know who the bad guys are, we know who the bad guy is. So that there's a little bit of comfort in that. I think that one of the challenges, though, is that as you face this kind of situation, you have the possibility that people are going to overreact in really negative ways. We've already seen some targeting of cops in different contexts. And I am personally very concerned that we're going to see a repeat of something like what happened in Dallas in 2016, where you have someone go out there and basically target cops at an event to try to kill as many of them as possible.
Yeah, you don't have to speculate about it. We've seen it in the past. I think I've also seen some numbers on the ability to recruit cops has become more difficult. You have fewer people who want to become police officers in some of these places because cops are being scapegoated the way they are. And you're right. So this false narrative, this misleading information that is put out there by the activists and amplified by the press is not just idle talk or nonsense. It's dangerous. Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous because it can lead to exactly what you're talking about, cops becoming targets. But it's also dangerous because what we know from just more recent examples in Ferguson and Chicago and Baltimore and St. Louis, when cops come under attack this way, and when it's not just the individual bad acting cops that come under attack, but entire police departments, it affects policing. It affects proactive policing, their willingness to get out of the car and interact with civilians drops dramatically in the wake of these events, particularly when investigations are launched with the entire department. And that leads to more crime, more violent crime, more homicides of the very, in the very same communities where the original event took place. And we, you know, we have some empirical data out there on this drop off in policing and police civilian contact in these neighborhoods and these poor communities. And we just watch the violent crime rates spike. So this is very consequential stuff. And of course it also has huge, economic ramifications. People always talk about how poverty causes crime, but I think the reverse of that is closer to the truth. You know, businesses leave crime-ridden neighborhoods, jobs follow, property values fall. So there are huge long-term effects here on what's going on with these protests and these attitudes towards police.
Let's talk about property for a minute. Nicole Hannah-Jones last week got a little attention, but not enough in my view, for saying that destruction of property is not violence because it can be replaced. She also the same week said that the Second Amendment is based in white supremacy. It is not, that it's ahistorical, like much of her work. But the takeaway that I had was that destruction of property isn't violence, but using the primary method that people use to defend their property is, and that it's racist violence on top of that. Is the conversation among our media elite so at a distance from basic understandings of the rights of property and the rights of property owners, especially when it comes to the kinds of stores we were seeing demolished, you know, not just chains and Verizon stores and the like, Targets, but, you know, family-owned bodegas, small businesses that won't be able to recover, in many cases, minority-owned businesses that won't be able to recover. How did we get so far afield from what I felt was always a basic shared understanding that these things are good, that you should like those things, and that you should particularly like them if you are, let's say, not the biggest fan of huge big box stores coming in?
Well, you know, I think Walmart and Target have yet to decide whether they're going to reopen in Chicago, where their stores were looted recently. And you think about the disproportionate number of low-skill workers they hire in a largely, you know, minority city, and the number of jobs that would be lost. And then what that also, the downstream effect there is only, you know, fewer businesses in these communities, and the businesses that do open will have to charge much higher prices for goods and services because they don't have Walmart and Target scale. So then you'll have people like Nicole Hannah-Jones coming in and saying, why is this bodega or little mini mart charging this much for a gallon of milk? You know, they're gouging the black community because they're racist. No, the cost of doing business in that community has gone up, particularly when there are no police around. Yeah. You know, that's all going to factor into a business's ability to operate, a willingness to operate in these communities. So these are huge conversation. The shame here, you know, Nicole Hannah-Jones is a Pulitzer winning, prize winning journalist at one of the nation's leading newspapers. So this isn't some, you know, left-wing progressive crank writing, you know, for Mother Jones or something like that. You know, this is a mainstream journalist at a leading publication who holds these views. And I think she is someone very much worth mentioning in the context of what's going on right now, and particularly because of how she won her Pulitzer Prize and gained so much notoriety over this so-called 1619 project that said, you know, this country was founded on slavery, that the American Revolution was fought to preserve slavery. And so when you hear someone on television now talking about, you know, bringing down statues of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, if you come at this from the Nicole Hannah-Jones perspective, that is perfectly consistent because there is no difference. If the American Revolution was fought to preserve slavery, as the Civil War was fought to preserve slavery by Confederates, there's no difference between Jefferson Davis and Thomas Jefferson. You know, there's just no difference. So that's where we are. And that is the mindset she brings to this discussion, which is that all of the racial inequality that we see today, whether it's in policing or incarceration, whether it's in school achievement, whether it's in the unemployment rate, household incomes, home ownership rates, it's all rooted in slavery. It's all a legacy of slavery. And that is where she comes at this from. And so many others have bought into this narrative. And it's led us to this point here where you have people, you know, these protests are about, you know, ending racism, ending inequality. These are utopian dreams. This is, but from Nicole Hannah Jones's perspective, nothing can be asked of Black people until this country is vanquished of racism. That is the standard she has.
And it's an impossible standard.
Property values and what we can do, none of that matters. Black behavior, we cannot talk about Black behavior because racism exists. And unless it is no longer exist in this country, she'll say, don't talk to me about Black behavior.
And of course, that's an impossible standard to ever meet. That irredeemably racist narrative that she advances, it's clearly part of what's infecting the conversation about all of these different statues and the need to bring them down. The thing that I think is really so challenging about that for many people is that there are statues that they may feel less comfortable with, you know, ones that they would like to see moved. I mean, I personally, you know, I don't think that Jefferson Davis should be somebody who is, you know, held up in any kind of high esteem or put, you know, above town squares and the like. I'm personally fine with, you know, moving any statues you want to keep of him into museums. But the flip side of that is there are many people, including some Confederates, who went on to have careers afterwards that are very admirable. I think an example of that would be somebody like James Longstreet, who was key to Grant's administration in helping the country come together, was viewed as a traitor by many in the South for putting down some of the rebellions that happened after the war, you know, in a military capacity. You know, someone who I think that we ought to, you know, respect, if not venerate or something like that, but just like, there's no reason to take down this guy's statues for places that, you know, feel that it's appropriate. And yet there doesn't seem to be any context for that kind of discussion. And that brings us to the kind of scene you saw play out in Minneapolis, which just infuriated me. This knocking down of this statue built by Christopher Columbus. Yeah. And as I'm sure you know, whenever you see a statue of Christopher Columbus somewhere in the country and it looks like something that was built in the 1920s or 30s, then it was probably made by an Italian immigrant. And sure enough, this one was. And it turns out he's actually someone who worked on Grand Central Station, who had his kids born in New Jersey. You know, he names his son Amerigo. And they move to Minnesota and they start making all these statues. They work on all these major buildings and churches and the like. And then his statue of Columbus that they knocked down was so well received, commissioned as it was by the Italian progressives in the area, that he's asked to make another one for the World's Fair, which is standing in Chicago. Today I saw this controversy in Britain about people clamoring to bring down Gandhi's statue. Gandhi, Jason. I mean, come on.
We've reached these levels of absurdity. The statue debate to me is off base as the policing debate to me. What is your goal here? Yeah. Is taking down a statue going to close the achievement gap in schools? Is it going to bring down the Black unemployment rate? Is it going to reduce Black crime rates that draw so much police attention in the first place? What are we going to accomplish? Who wants to die on this hill?
Yeah.
Let's say you take them down. What have you accomplished? And that's what, again, is so frustrating to me here, that these are distractions. We're not focused on the types of things that will get us closer to where we want to be as a country. If you're obsessed over social inequality or income inequality, obsessing over policing and obsessing over Confederate statues just seems to me very wide of the mark. I mean, and these are difficult conversations to have, particularly among Black elites, because they have to air a lot of dirty laundry in yeah. public in terms of Black behavior and Black culture and Black values and habits and attitudes and so forth. And at the end of the day, what is drawing police to these communities are the high Black crime rates. And if you're going to have a subset of the community that makes up only, you know, 12 or 13% of the population, committing more than half of all murders, committing close to 60% of all robberies, having violent crime rates that are 7 to 10 times higher than white crime rates, you're going to attract the lion's share of police attention. There will be tension between poor Black communities and law enforcement until you bring down those numbers. Mm-hmm. And that's the conversation we should be having. How do you bring down those numbers? And instead, we're having a conversation over police tactics. And I just don't think that's going to get us where we want to go.
Why do you think that President Obama didn't get a better handle on this during his presidency? Do you think that he tried?
Well, I think the sort of community activist in Obama came to the fore during a lot of these incidents, whether it was Trayvon Martin or Freddie Gray. And then he had, a Black attorney general and Eric Holder, who I think also brought a very leftist mentality to these incidents. And they saw this as an opportunity to push an agenda, a political agenda. I think we saw a lot of these piggyback investigations going on. As soon as something would happen, the Justice Department would head out there, whether it was to Ferguson or to Baltimore, where have you, and do their own investigation without letting the locals handle things first, stepping back, letting them complete things, and then if they saw something awry, stepping in. It was an immediate push to look like they were doing something. And that's what I think happened there. But at the end of the day, I don't think the solutions for these problems are going to come out of Washington. They're going to come out of these communities.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And that's what's got to happen. And, there's this talk now about federal guidelines for policing. And I just think this would be a disaster, right? Mm-hmm. A one size fits all policing template. When you have completely different populations in different states, or even in different parts of states, different cultures, different histories, traditions, you can't solve this problem in Washington.
Let's go out on this, Jason. There's a frustration, I think, on the part of many white Americans who feel like they want to express a degree of affinity and quote unquote ally status with the Black Lives Matter movement. They're not necessarily policy sophisticates in analyzing what that means, but they're caught in this tension where they know that they're not racist, or they don't think that they're racist. They want to signal that they're not racist. They're being pressured by everybody in the media and in the celebrity culture and by corporate America to engage in behavior that indicates that. They want to partake of that, or they want to participate with it, and not out of some woke leftism, but just because they really do feel like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. We've got to do something about this. And yet what they're being guided toward by the media is a situation where you're either choosing this racist pro-cop narrative or the light of sun and progressive, positive thinking through the Black Lives Matter movement. And let's ignore the radicalism of what their actual agenda looks like.
Yeah.
What would you say to people who feel like they're caught in that situation?
Don't condescend to Black people. Black should be held to the same standards as everyone else, not lower standards. And if you see behaviors out there that are outrageous, out of line, something you would reprimand any family member or white friend you know for behaving in such or engaging in such behavior, hold black people to the same standard. I think it's insulting to do otherwise, deeply insulting to do otherwise. And don't assume that the activists are speaking for the larger black community. I mean, one of the very frustrating things for me during this whole episode is George Floyd being held up as a typical black American, black American, and this being a typical experience for a black American. You know, George Floyd did not deserve to die in the way that he did. No one does. But George Floyd was not a typical black American. Most blacks are not poor. Most blacks do not have criminal records. And this man, throughout his adult life, was in and out of trouble with the law. He is not typical. Most blacks are law-abiding citizens, pay their taxes, want to live in safe neighborhoods, send their kids to safe schools. And the idea that you take the worst that a group has to offer and make them representative of that group, I think is just terrible, and it really annoys me that he's being held up as your prototypical black American. What he went through is the prototypical black American experience. It's just not true, and it's not something I want white people to indulge that view of black America.
You can follow Jason Riley on Twitter at Jason Riley WSJ. Jason, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Ben. Take care.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.